varsity was fierce. Meanwhile, infantry and armored divisions of the U.S. First Army were pouring across the Rhine via the recently captured Ludendorff Bridge at Remagen, then swinging north to encircle the German army defending Germany's industrial heartland in the Ruhr. Eisenhower needed to bolster the ring around the Ruhr. The 82nd and 101st were available. The orders came at the end of March. The company was moving out, back to the front, this time on the Rhine River. The veterans resolved not to take any chances. The end of the war was in sight, and they now believed what they could not believe at Bastogne, that they were going to make it safe, more or less intact. They wanted to escape the boredom of garrison. They knew how to take care of themselves. They were ready to do their job, but not to be heroes. In contrast to the veterans, the replacements thought Mourmelon was a super place. They trained with veterans day and night in realistic problems, all under the watchful eye of a man who was a legend in E Company, Major Winters. They had learned life-saving lessons. They had gotten to know and be accepted by the veterans. They were proud to be in the company, the regiment, the division, and were eager to show that they were qualified to be there. So Easy was ready at the end of March, when orders came to prepare to move out. It would be by truck to the Rhine. Webster was delighted to be getting out of Mourmelon, apprehensive and excited about going back into combat, and disappointed that he was not jumping into battle. "I had hoped to make another jump," he wrote, "rather than ride to the front in trucks, for there is an element of chance in an airborne mission. It may be rough, it may be easy. Perhaps there will be no enemy at all, which appeals to me more than the prosaic infantry attack against an enemy who knows where you are and when you're coming." Private O'Keefe was about to enter combat for the first time. He has a vivid memory of the occasion. "We wore light sweaters under field jackets, trousers bloused over combat boots, trench knife strapped on right leg, pistol belts with attached musette bags, one phosphorus grenade and one regular hand grenade taped onto our chest harness, canteens, first aid kit, K-rations stuffed into our pockets, steel helmet and rifle. We carried cloth bandoliers for our rifle clips in place of the old-fashioned cartridge belts. Our musette bags carried a minimum of shorts, socks, shaving gear, sewing kit, cigarettes, etc. After hearing Mass celebrated by Father John Maloney and receiving a general absolution, O'Keefe pulled himself into a truck and was off for Germany. Easy Company was about to enter its fifth country. The men had liked Britain and the English people enormously. They did not like the French, who seemed to them ungrateful, sullen, lazy, and dirty. They had a special relationship with the Belgians because of their intimate association with the civilians of Bastogne, who had done whatever they could to support the Americans. They loved the Dutch, brave, resourceful, overwhelmingly grateful, the best organized underground in Europe, cellars full of food hidden from the Germans but given to the Americans, clean, hard-working, honest, were only some of the compliments the men showered on the Dutch. Now they were going to meet the Germans. For the first time, they would be on front lines inside enemy territory, living with enemy civilians. And if the rumor proved true, the one that said instead of living in foxholes, they were going to be billeted in German houses, they would be getting to know the Germans in an intimate fashion. This would be especially true once the Ruhr pocket was eliminated and the advance across central Germany began. Then they would be staying in a different house every night under conditions in which the occupants would have only a few minutes' notice of their arrival. They would be coming as conquerors who had been told to distrust all Germans and who had been forbidden by the non-fraternization policy to have any contact with German civilians. But except for Liebgott and a few others, they had no undying hatred of the Germans. Many of them admired the German soldiers they had fought. Webster was not alone in feeling that most of the atrocities they had heard about were propaganda. Anyway, they would soon see for themselves whether all the Germans were Nazis, and if the Nazis were as bad as the Allied press and radio said they were. Chapter 16. Getting to Know the Enemy. Germany, April 2nd through 30th, 1945. The reactions of the men of Easy to the German people depended on their different preconceptions and experiences. Some found reasons to reinforce their hatred. Others loved the country and the people. Nearly everyone ended up changing his mind. All of them were fascinated. The standard story of how the American GI reacted to the foreign people he met during the course of World War II runs like this. He felt the Arabs were despicable, liars, thieves, dirty, awful, without a redeeming feature. The Italians were liars, thieves, dirty, wonderful, with many redeeming features, but never to be trusted. The rural French were sullen, slow, and ungrateful, while the Parisians were rapacious, cunning, indifferent to whether they were cheating Germans or Americans. The British people were brave, resourceful, quaint, reserved, dull. The Dutch were, as noted, regarded as simply wonderful in every way. But the average GI never was in Holland, only the airborne. The story ends up thus. Wonder of wonders, the average GI found that the people he liked best, identified most closely with, enjoyed being with, were the Germans. Clean, hard-working, disciplined, educated, middle class in their tastes and lifestyles. Many GIs noted that, so far as they could tell, the only people in the world who regarded a flush toilet and soft white toilet paper as a necessity were the Germans and the Americans. The Germans seemed to many American soldiers as just like us. GIs noted with approval that the Germans began picking up the rubble the morning after the battle had passed by, and contrasted that with the French, where no one yet had bothered to clean up the mess. Obviously, they noted with high approval all those young German girls and the absence of competition from young German boys. They loved the German food and beer. But most of all, they loved the German homes. They stayed in many homes, from the Rhine through Bavaria to Austria, sometimes a different one each night. Invariably, they found running hot and cold water, electric lights, a proper toilet and paper, coal for the stove. Webster wrote of this period, "Coming off guard into your own home was a sensation unequaled in the army. We left the hostile blackness behind when we opened the outside door. Beyond the blackout curtains, a light glowed, and as we hung our rifles on the hat rack and shed our raincoats, idle chatter drifted from the kitchen and gave us a warm, settled feeling. A pot of coffee would be simmering on the stove. Help yourself. Reese would be telling about a shack job he had in London, while Janovich, Hickman, Collette, and Schulte played blackjack. Wash your hands at the sink. This was home. This was where we belonged. A small, sociable group, a clean, well-lighted house, a cup of coffee. Paradise. Even better, the men were not getting shot at or shooting. No wonder so many of them liked Germany so much. But as Webster commented, in explaining the superficial fondness of the GI for the Germans, it might be well to remember the physical comforts which he enjoyed nowhere else in the army but in the land of his enemies. The experiences of the men of E Company in Germany illustrates how much better off during the war the German people were than the people of Britain, France, Belgium, and Holland. Of course, in the big cities in Germany, it was, by mid-April of 1945, Götterdämmerung. But in the countryside and small villages where, although there was usually some destruction at the main crossroads, the houses generally were intact, complete with creature comforts such as most people thought existed in 1945 only in America. By no means was every GI seduced by the Germans. Webster went into Germany with a complex attitude. He didn't like Germans. He thought all Germans were Nazis. But he discounted as propaganda the stories about concentration camps and other atrocities. He found the German people too hard-faced. He thought the French were dead and rotting. But Germany was only a crippled tiger licking its wounds, resting with a burning hatred in its breast, ready to try again. And it will. Despite himself, Webster was drawn to the people. The Germans I have seen so far have impressed me as clean, efficient, law-abiding people, he wrote his parents on April 14th. They were churchgoers. In Germany, everybody goes out and works, and unlike the French, who do not seem inclined to lift a finger to help themselves, the Germans fill up the trenches soldiers have dug in their fields. They are cleaner, more progressive, and more ambitious than either the English or the French. Writing of the GI's experience with the German people, and of the effect of feeling that they were just like us, Glenn Gray points out, "The enemy could not have changed so quickly from a beast to a likable human being. Thus the conclusion is nearly forced upon the GIs that they had been previously blinded by fear and hatred and the propaganda of their own government." Orders from on high were non-fraternization. GIs were not supposed to talk to any Germans, even small children, except on official business. This absurd order, which flew in the face of human nature in so obvious a way, was impossible to enforce. Officers, especially those who hated the Germans, tried anyway. Webster was amused by the intensity of Lieutenant Foley's feelings. He wrote that Foley had become such a fiend on the non-fraternization policy that he ordered all butts field-stripped, that is, torn apart and scattered, so that the Germans might derive no pleasure from American tobacco. Webster also recalled the time that he and Foley were picking out houses for the night. "As we walked around to the backyard for a closer inspection, we were greeted with a horrifying spectacle that aroused all the non-fraternization fervor in Foley. Two infantrymen sociably chatting with a couple of Fräulein. Unspeakable, outrageous, unmilitary, forbidden. Lieutenant Foley gave them hell and bade them be on their way." With the resigned air of men who knew the barren futility of the non-fraternization policy, the gallants sulkily departed. It is worth pausing here to see the Americans as conquerors through the microcosm of E Company. They took what they wanted, but by no means did they rape, loot, pillage, and burn their way through Germany. If they did not respect property rights, in the sense that they commandeered their nightly billets without compensation, at least when the Germans moved back in after they left, the place was more or less intact. Of course, there were some rapes, some mistreatment of individual Germans, and some looting. But it is simple fact to state that other conquering armies in World War II, perhaps most of all the Russian, but including the Japanese and German, acted differently. Webster told a story that speaks to the point. Reese, who was more intent on finding women than in trading for eggs, and I, made another expedition, a mile west to a larger village where there were no GIs. Like McCreary, Reese tended to show an impatience with hens and a strong interest in skirts. Regardless of age or appearance, he'd tell me, "There's a nice one. Boy, that's a honey. Speak to her, Webb, goddamn." Since I was shy, however, and those females invariably looked about as sociable as a fresh iceberg, I ignored his panting plaints. Besides, the Fraus weren't apt to be friendly in public, where the neighbors could see them. Maybe indoors or at night. Finally, we came to a farm where a buxom peasant lass greeted us. Reese smiled. After I had gotten some eggs, Reese, who kept winking at her, gave her a cigarette and a chocolate bar, and as love bloomed in the garden of D-Ration, a newly issued food package, and Chelsea's, I backed out of the door and waited in the sun. "No dice," Reese later reported. I returned home with a helmet full of eggs, Reese with a broken heart. But it was, as he said, good fraternizing territory. He tried again that night before 6 o'clock curfew went into effect. No luck. Had Reese been a Soviet, German, or Japanese soldier, this little non-incident probably would have turned out differently. The company moved by truck from Mourmelon to the Ruhr pocket. The 101st took up positions on the west bank of the Rhine facing Düsseldorf. The 2nd Battalion sector was from Stutzelberg on the north to Vorringham on the south, with the 82nd Airborne on the battalion's right flank. The 82nd faced Cologne. It was more an occupation position than front line. The platoons kept outposts down on the riverbank, while the men stayed in homes in various small villages. There was some artillery shelling back and forth, but not much. There was no small arms fire. The men were on outpost each night. Here, Private O'Keefe got his initiation. One night, he was on outpost with Private Harry Lager, who had also just joined the company at Mourmelon in a ready-made foxhole beside the dike. They heard a thump, thump, thump. O'Keefe whispered to Lager, "Stay in the hole, but make room for me to drop in a hurry. I'm going up on that dike to see if I can make out what that is approaching." "Up on the dike," O'Keefe recalled. "I couldn't see a damn thing, but the noise was almost on top of me. Suddenly the nose of a small tank stuck out through the fog. I yelled, 'Halt, who goes there?' and ready to dive off that dike into the hole with Lager. A voice came out of the tank, 'It's just a couple of limeys and we're lost.' O'Keefe ordered the men to come down to be inspected. A British sergeant did so, saying, 'By God, Yank, are we glad to see you. We started out on that bloody dike at midnight and we can't find our way off.' 'What's making that noise?' O'Keefe asked. 'Oh, that,' the Brit replied. 'It's one of our treads. It's broke. We can only travel about 2 miles an hour. The tread goes around but hits the ground on each rotation.' O'Keefe suggested that the sergeant put his crewmate out in front, walking ahead, else they might get plastered at the next checkpoint. The sergeant said he would. O'Keefe rejoined Lager, glad to note that Lager had them covered with his M1 the whole time. The little incident gave Lager and O'Keefe confidence in themselves and one another. They decided they had the hang of it. Another night, at another place along the river, O'Keefe was on outpost with a recent recruit, Private James Welling. From West Virginia, Welling was 30 years old, making him just about the oldest man in the company. O'Keefe was the youngest. Although Welling had just joined the company, he was a combat veteran who had been wounded in the Battle of the Bulge, volunteered for paratroopers after discharge from hospital in England, made all 5 qualifying jumps in one day, and was now a member of the 101st. On the outpost, they were standing in a waist-deep foxhole when a 10-ton truck came barreling along the road. "Halt!" O'Keefe yelled, 3 times. No one heard him. A convoy of 9 trucks, bumper to bumper, passed him by, engines roaring. "What do you do when you yell halt and you realize they'll never hear you?" O'Keefe asked Welling. "Not much you can do," he replied. Half an hour later, the trucks came back, full speed, except now there were only 8 trucks. "Jim, what's down that road?" O'Keefe asked.
"I don't know. Nobody said."
A quarter of an hour later, Captain Spears showed up, madder than hell. He shouted at Welling, "Why didn't you stop those trucks? The bridge is out down there, and one of those trucks is now hanging over the edge." Having heard various stories about Spears' temper, O'Keefe expected the worst. But Welling shouted right back, "How the hell were we going to stop 9 trucks going full bore? And why didn't someone tell us the bridge was out? Hell, we didn't even know there was a bridge there." "Where's the other guard?" Spears demanded. O'Keefe stepped out of a shadow with his M1 pointed about waist high and said as menacingly as he could, "Right here, sir." Spears grunted and left.
A night or so later, a jeep came along, no lights.
Welling called out, "Halt!" The jeep contained Captain Spears, another captain, and a major in the back seat. Welling said the password.
Spears gave the countersign in a normal conversational tone. Welling couldn't make out what he had said and repeated the challenge.
Spears answered in the same tone. Welling still didn't hear him. Tense and a bit confused, O'Keefe lined up his M1 on the major in the back. He looked closely and realized it was Winters. Welling gave the password for the 3rd time. The captain, who was driving, finally realized Welling had not heard and yelled out the countersign. Spears jumped out of the jeep and started to curse out Welling. Welling cut him off. "When I say halt, I mean halt. When I give the password, I expect to hear the countersign." Spears started sputtering about what he was going to do to Welling when Winters interrupted. "Let's go, Captain," he said in a low voice. As they drove off, Winters called out to Welling, "Good job." There were patrols across the Rhine, seldom dangerous except for the strong current in the flooded river nearly 350 meters wide. When Winters got orders on April 8th to send a patrol to the other side, he decided to control the patrol from an observation post to make certain no one got hurt.
Winters set the objectives and controlled the covering artillery concentration, then monitored the patrol step by step up the east bank of the river. Lieutenant Welsh, Battalion S2, accompanied him and was disgusted with the safety limits Winters insisted on. "We went through the motions of a combat patrol," Winters remembered, "and found nothing. Everyone returned safely." Most patrols were similarly unsuccessful. Malarkey reported that a replacement officer took out a patrol, got across the river, advanced several hundred yards inland, drew fire from a single rifleman, reported over the radio that he had met stiff resistance, and withdrew to friendly territory, to the mingled relief and disgust of his men. A couple of days later, things didn't work out so well. The patrol leader was Major William Leach, recently promoted and made Regimental S2 by SYNC. He had been ribbed unmercifully back at Moor Milan when his gold leaves came through. "When are you going to take out a patrol, Leach?" his fellow officers asked. He had never been in combat and consequently had no decorations. Characterized by Winters as a good staff officer who made his way up the ladder on personality and social expertise, Leach wanted to make a career out of the Army. For that, he felt he needed a decoration. On the night of April 12th, Leach set out at the head of a four-man patrol from the S2 section at Regimental HQ, but he made one fatal mistake. He failed to tell anyone he was going. Easy Company men on outpost duty heard the splashing of a boat the patrol was using as it crossed the river. As far as they were concerned, unless they had been told of an American patrol at such and such a time, any boat in the river contained enemy troops. They opened up on it. Quickly, the machine guns joined in. The fire ripped the boat apart and hit all the men in it, including Leach. Ignoring the pitiful cries of the wounded drowning in the river, the machine gunners kept firing bursts at them until their bodies drifted away. They were recovered some days later downstream. In the judgment of the company, Leach and four men had perished in a most unnecessary, inexcusable fashion because he had made an obvious and unpardonable mistake. That day, the company got the news that President Roosevelt had died. Winters wrote in his daybook, "Sergeant Malley of F Company, good news, made first sergeant. Bad news, President Roosevelt died." "I had come to take Roosevelt for granted," Webster wrote his parents, "like spring and Easter lilies. And now that he is gone, I feel a little lost." Eisenhower ordered all unit commanders to hold a short memorial service for Roosevelt on Sunday, April 14th. Easy Company did it by platoons. Lieutenant Foley, who never was much enamored with Roosevelt, gathered his platoon. He had a St. Joseph missal in his musette bag. In it he found a prayer. He read it out to the men and later claimed to be the only man who ever buried Franklin D. as a Catholic. Overall, Easy's time on the Rhine guarding the Ruhr pocket was boring. "Time hung so heavily," a disgusted Webster wrote, "that we began to have daily rifle inspections. Otherwise, we did nothing but stand guard on the crossroads at night and listen to a short current events lecture by Lieutenant Foley during the day." With their high energy level and the low demands on them, the men turned to sports. They found some rackets and balls and played tennis on a backyard court, or softball in a nearby field. Webster was no athlete, but he had a high level of curiosity. One day he realized the fulfillment of a lifetime ambition when he and Private John Janovec scaled a 250-foot-high factory smokestack. When they got to the top, they had a magnificent view across the river. To Webster, the Ruhr seemed absolutely lifeless, even though everywhere we looked, there were factories, foundries, steel mills, sugar plants, and sheet metal works. It looked like Chicago, Pittsburgh, and St. Louis decentralized. On April 18th, all German resistance in the Ruhr pocket came to an end. More than 325,000 German soldiers surrendered. Easy was put to guarding a displaced persons camp at Dormagen. There were Poles, Czechs, Belgians, Dutch, French, Russians, and others from different parts of Nazi-occupied Europe in the camp, tens of thousands. They lived in a common barracks, segregated by sex, crowded, all but starving in many cases, representing all ranges of age. Once liberated, their impulse was to catch up on their rest and their fun, so sadly lacking for the past few years. Webster reported that they were contentedly doing nothing. They had worked hard under the Germans and eaten little. Now they would rest. Their happiness, singing, and willingness to do favors for the soldiers endeared them to the men of Easy. KP was now a thing of the past. No member of Easy ever peeled a potato after this point, or swept a room, or washed a mess kit, or policed the area. There were always DPs for that, especially as the Americans were so generous in paying. More than a few men took along a combination son and servant. Lutz practically adopted a thin little boy, Muchik, who wore battered shoes much too large. His parents had died in the slave labor camp. Muchik's big dark eyes and bright energetic demeanor were irresistible to Lutz. He got Muchik a uniform of sorts and brought him along for the tour of Germany, teaching him the fundamentals of army profanity as they rode along. As the division history notes, though strict orders were given that no DPs were to be taken along, some of the personnel spoke very broken English, never appeared in formations, and seemed to do a great deal of kitchen police. In short, Easy was about to depart on a tour of Germany that would be first class in every way. Comfortable homes each night, great food and wine, free to take almost whatever they wanted, being driven along an autobahn reserved for them, riding at a leisurely pace on big rubber tires, with wondrous sights to see. The dramatic Alps on one side, the dramatic disintegration of what had been the most feared army in the world on the other, with body servants to care for their every need. Except one. They would have loved to have brought some of the DP girls along, but they did no better with them than they had with the German girls. Like GIs everywhere, they assumed that a D-ration and a couple of Chelseas were the key to any woman's heart, only to be disappointed. The second-generation Czechs and Poles in the company had been especially excited. They spent all their spare time, night and day, using their limited language ability to court the stocky, balloon-chested peasant girls of their father's native lands. But contrary to their expectations, the girls, with their Catholic upbringing and Central European background, were chaste. For Webster, the effect of the DP camp was to stir up his hatred of the Germans. Why were these people here? He asked himself about the DPs. They had done nothing, had no politics, committed no crime, possessed nothing. They were there because the Nazis needed their labor. There was Germany and all it stood for, Webster concluded. The Germans had taken these people from their homes and sentenced them to work for life in a factory in the Third Reich. Babies and old women, innocent people, condemned to live in barracks behind barbed wires, to slave 12 hours a day for an employer without feeling or consideration, to eat beet soup, moldy potatoes, and black bread. This was the Third Reich. This was the new order. Work till you died. With cold deliberation, the Germans had enslaved the populace of Europe. So far as Webster was concerned, the German people were guilty. Every one of them. The guard duty lasted only a few days. Back on the Rhine, Winters instituted a training schedule that included reveille, inspection, calisthenics, and close-order drill, squad tactics, map reading, and so forth. The day ended with retreat. It was like being back in basic training, and much resented. As always, in a rear echelon area, rank was being pulled, widening the distance between the enlisted men and the officers. Lieutenant Ralph D. Ritchie, a gung-ho replacement officer serving as Battalion S1, was particularly obnoxious. One day, he had the company lined up for inspection. An old German woman rode her bicycle innocently through the ranks. Ritchie became so enraged that he fetched her a blow that knocked her off her bicycle. She burst into tears. He stormed at her and ordered her to move on. The men were disgusted by his behavior. The following day, the company made a forced 5-mile speed march, Lieutenant Ritchie leading. The men rolled up their sleeves and carried their weapons as comfortably as possible. Ritchie was furious. He halted the company and gave the men hell. "I have never seen such a sloppy company," he shouted. There are 120 men in this company, and I see 120 different ways of carrying a rifle. And you guys think you're soldiers. The incident set Webster off on a tirade. Here was a man who had made us ashamed of our uniform, railing at us for being comfortable on a speed march, he wrote. Here was the army. Officers are gentlemen. I'll do as I damn please. No back talk. You're a private. You can't think. If you were any good, you'd be an officer. Here, carry my bedroll. Sweep my room. Clean my carbine. Yes, sir. Why didn't you salute? You didn't see me. Well, by God, go back and salute properly. The Louis, God bless him. Privileges before responsibilities. Not all officers were like Richie. Captain Spears, for all his bluster and reputation, cared for the men. Sensing their boredom, he arranged a sightseeing trip to Cologne. He wanted them to see the city and the effects of air bombardment. Cologne was one of the most heavily bombed cities in Germany. Two things most impressed the men. First, the extent of the destruction. Every window was shattered. Every church had been hit. Every side street was blocked with rubble. The magnificent cathedral in the center of town had been damaged, but had survived. The giant statue of Bismarck on a horse was still standing, but Bismarck's sword, pointing toward France, had been cut off by flying shrapnel. A group of easy men wandered to the Rhine, where they began pointing and laughing at the grotesque ruins of the Hängebrücke, or suspension bridge. An elderly German couple stood beside them. To the shame of the Americans, the Germans began to cry and shake their heads. All their beautiful bridges had been twisted and mangled, and here were American boys laughing. The second impression was not of destruction, but of people. Lieutenant Foley noted that the residents on their own volition were determined to clean up and sweep out the ruins of war. Along most of the streets, there were neat stacks of salvageable cobblestones. Houses were worked on to remove the debris. They were still in bad shape, yet they appeared almost ready to be rebuilt. Amazing. April 19th was a big day for the company. The division quartermaster handed out 34 pairs of socks per platoon, or about one pair for each man, plus three bottles of Coca-Cola, accompanied by stern orders to turn in the bottles, and two bottles of American beer per man. The men got paid for February and March in the form of Allied military marks. These were their first marks, and they were ordered to turn in all their French, British, Dutch, Belgian, and American money for marks. On April 22nd, the company loaded up in the German version of the 40-8s. The cars had been sprayed with DDT and filled with straw. Each man got 5 K-rations. They were off to Bavaria and the Alps. Bradley had assigned the 101st to U.S. 7th Army. Its objectives were Munich, Innsbruck, and the Brenner Pass. The purpose was to get American troops into the Alps before the Germans could create a redoubt there from which to continue the war. Hitler's Eagle's Nest in Berchtesgaden was the presumed HQ for this combination last stand and the beginning of a guerrilla war against the occupiers. Eisenhower's biggest fear was that Hitler would get to the Eagle's Nest, where he would be well protected and have radio facilities he could use to broadcast to the German people to continue the resistance or begin guerrilla warfare. It turned out that the Germans had neither serious plans nor sufficient resources to build a mountain redoubt. But remember, we are only 4 months away from a time when everyone assumed the German army was kaput, only to be hit by the bulge. So the fear was there. But the reality was that in its drive to Berchtesgaden, Easy was as much as 100 miles behind the front line, in a reserve position, never threatened. The company's trip through Germany was more a grand tour than a fighting maneuver. The tour began with a 200-kilometer train ride through 4 countries. So great was the Allied destruction of the German rail system that to get from the Ruhr to southern Germany, it was necessary to go through Holland, Belgium, Luxembourg, and France. The men rode in open cars, sleeping, singing, swinging their feet out the doors, sunbathing on the roof of the 40-8. Popeye Wynn led them in endless choruses of the ETO theme song, Roll Me Over in the Clover. The train passed within 25 miles of Bastogne. The division history commented, The occasional evidence of the bitter fighting of 3 months before made the hair rise on the necks of many of the veterans of Bastogne. But at the same time, remembering only snow, cold, and dark and ominous forests, they were surprised at the beauty of the rolling lands under the new green of spring. They got back into Germany and then to the Rhine at Ludwigshafen, where they got off the train and switched to a vehicle called DUKW. D, 1942, U, amphibian, K, all-wheel drive, W, dual rear axles. These DUKWs had come in with the invasion of the south of France. These were the first E Company had seen. The DUKW was outstanding in every respect, but because it was a hybrid, neither the war nor the Navy Department ever really got behind it. Only 21,000 were built in the course of the war. The men of E Company wished it had been 210,000, or even 2,100,000. A DUKW could carry 20 fully equipped riflemen in considerable comfort. It could make 5 knots in a moderate sea, 50 miles per hour on land, riding on oversized rubber tires. It was a smooth-riding vehicle without the bounce of the deuce-and-a-half GI truck or the springless jarring of the Jeep. Webster said the DUKW rides softly up and down like a sailboat in a gentle swell. They crossed the Rhine on the Ernie Pyle Bridge, a pontoon structure built by the engineers, and headed toward Munich. They went through Heidelberg, and Webster was entranced. When we saw all the undamaged buildings and the beautiful river promenade, where complacent civilians strolled in the sun, I was ready to stay in Heidelberg forever. The green hills, the warm sunlight, the cool, inviting river, the mellow, collegiate atmosphere. Heidelberg spelled paradise in any language. From then on, the convoy traveled a circuitous route southeast, skirting mountains, on main roads and side paths. All the while, Webster wrote, we marveled at the breathtaking beauty of Germany. As a writer said in the New Yorker, it seemed a pity to waste such country on the Germans. In mid-afternoon, Spears would send Sergeants Carson and Malarkey on ahead to pick out a company CP in such and such a village. They were to get the best house and reserve the best bedroom for Captain Spears. Carson had high school German. He would pick the place, knock on the door, and tell the Germans they had 5 minutes to get out, and they were not to take any bedding with them. Give them more than 5 minutes, Spears had told them. They will take everything with them. Once the advance party came on an apartment complex 3 stories high, perfect for HQ and most of the company. Carson knocked on doors and told tenants, Raus in 5 minuten. They came pouring out, crying, lamenting, frightened. I knocked on this one door, Carson recalled, and an elderly lady answered. I looked at her and she stared at me. God, it was a picture of my own grandmother. Our eyes met and I said, Bleib hier, or stay here. Malarkey picked up the story. Then Spears would finally show up and you wouldn't see Spears for about 2 or 3 hours. He was the worst looter I ever saw. He couldn't sleep at night thinking there was a necklace or something around. Whenever he got a chance, Spears would mail his loot back to his wife in England. He needed the money it would bring. His wife just had a baby. Nearly all the men of Easy, like nearly all the men in ETO, participated in the looting. It was a phenomenon of war. Thousands of men who had never before in their lives taken something of value that did not belong to them began taking it for granted that whatever they wanted was theirs. The looting was profitable, fun, low risk, and completely in accord with the practice of every conquering army since Alexander the Great's time. Lugers, Nazi insignia, watches, jewelry, first editions of Mein Kampf, liquor, were among the most sought-after items. Anything any German soldier had was fair game. Looting from civilians was frowned upon, but it happened anyway. Money was not highly valued. Sergeant Edward Heffron and medic Ralph Spina caught a half dozen German soldiers in a house. The Germans surrendered. Heffron and Spina took their watches, a beautiful set of binoculars, and so forth. They spotted a strongbox on the shelf. Spina opened it. It was a Wehrmacht payroll in marks. They took it. In Spina's words, there we were, two boys from South Philly, who just pulled off a payroll caper with a carbine and a pistol. Back at their apartment, Heffron and Spina debated what to do with the money as they knocked back a bottle of cognac. In the morning, they went to Mass at the Catholic Church and gave the money away to the worshippers. With the exception of some bills of large denominations, which we split up, Spina confessed. We weren't that drunk not to keep any for ourselves. They took vehicles of all types, private and army. Private Norman Nitzky, who had come in at Hagenau, remembered the time his squad started to drive away in a German ambulance, only to find that a German doctor with a pregnant woman was in the back trying to deliver a baby. The Americans hopped out. One morning, Lieutenant Ritchie grabbed the camera of a German woman photographing the convoy. But instead of taking it, he threw it on the ground and shot it with his pistol. This earned him the nickname the Camera Killer. Contact with the enemy picked up as the convoy moved southeast, but not in the sense of combat. The men began to see German soldiers and small groups trying to surrender, then larger groups. Finally, more field gray uniforms than anyone could have imagined existed. Easy Company was in the midst of a German army in disintegration. The supply system lay in ruins. All the German soldiers wanted was a safe entry into a POW cage. I couldn't get over the sensation of having the Germans, who only a short time ago had been so difficult to capture, come in from the hills like sheep and surrender, Webster wrote. When the convoy reached the Autobahn leading east to Munich, the road was reserved for Allied military traffic, the median for Germans marching west to captivity. Gordon Carson recalled that as far as you could see in the median were German prisoners, fully armed. No one would stop to take their surrender. We just waved. Webster called the sight of the Germans in the median a tingling spectacle. They came on in huge blocks. We saw the unbelievable spectacle of two GIs keeping watch on some 2,500 enemy. At that moment, the men of the company realized that the German collapse was complete, that there would be no recovery this spring as there had been last fall. There was still some scattered, sporadic resistance. Every single bridge was destroyed by German engineers as the Allies approached. Occasionally, a fanatic SS unit would fire from its side of the stream. It was more an irritant than a threat or danger. The Americans would bring forward some light artillery, drive the SS troops away, and wait for the engineers to repair the old or make a new bridge. Winters was struck by the German fanaticism, the discipline that led German engineers to blow their own bridges when the uselessness of the destruction was clear to any idiot, and the total futility of the war. Here was a German army trying to surrender and walking north along the Autobahn, while at the same time another group was blowing out the bridges to slow down the surrender. On April 29th, the company stopped for the night at Buchloe in the foothills of the Alps, near Landsberg. Here they saw their first concentration camp. It was a work camp, not an extermination camp, one of the half dozen or more that were part of the Dachau complex. But although it was relatively small and designed to produce war goods, it was so horrible that it was impossible to fathom the enormity of the evil. Prisoners in their striped pajamas, three-quarters starved by the thousands, corpses little more than skeletons by the hundreds. Winters found stacks of huge wheels of cheese in the cellar of a building he was using for the battalion CP and ordered it distributed to the inmates. He radioed to regiment to describe the situation and ask for help. The company stayed in Buchloe for 2 nights. Thus it was present in the morning when the people of Landsberg turned out, carrying rakes, brooms, shovels, and marched off to the camp. General Taylor, it turned out, had been so incensed by the sight that he had declared martial law and ordered everyone from 14 to 80 years of age to be rounded up and sent to the camp to bury the bodies and clean up the place. That evening, the crew came back down the road from the camp. Some were still vomiting. The memory of starved, dazed men, Winters wrote, who dropped their eyes and heads when we looked at them through the chain-link fence, in the same manner that a beaten, mistreated dog would cringe, leaves feelings that cannot be described and will never be forgotten. The impact of seeing those people behind that fence left me saying only to myself, "Now I know why I am here." Chapter 17. Drinking Hitler's Champagne. Berchtesgaden, May 1st through 8th, 1945. On the first 2 days of May, the company drove south from Munich, moving slowly through streams of German soldiers walking in the opposite direction. Often there were more German soldiers with weapons going north than there were Americans going south. We looked at each other with great curiosity, Winters remembered. I am sure both armies shared one thought. Just let me alone. All I want is to get this over with and go home. On May 3rd, Colonel Sink got orders to have the 506th ready to move out at 09:30 the following day. Objective, Berchtesgaden. Berchtesgaden was a magnet for the troops of all the armies in southern Germany, Austria, and northern Italy. South of Salzburg, the Bavarian mountain town of Berchtesgaden was Valhalla for the Nazi gods, lords, and masters. Hitler had a home there, and a mountaintop stone retreat called the Aldershorst, Eagle's Nest, 8,000 feet high. Thanks to a remarkable job of road building, cars could get to a parking place within a few hundred feet of the Aldershorst. There, a shaft ran into the center of the mountain to an elevator which lifted into the Aldershorst. The walls of the elevator were gold leaf. It was to Berchtesgaden that the leaders of Europe had come in the late 1930s to be humiliated by Hitler. Daladier of France, Mussolini of Italy, Schuschnigg of Austria, Chamberlain of Britain, and others. They had feared Hitler, as had the whole world. Now that Hitler was dead, the fear was removed. But that only highlighted the fascination with Hitler and his favorite retreat, which seemed to hold one of the keys to his character. It was to Berchtesgaden that the highest-ranking Nazi leadership had flocked, to be near their Führer. Himmler, Göring, Goebbels, Martin Bormann had houses in the area. There was a fabulous apartment complex for the SS. It was to the Berchtesgaden area that much of the loot collected by the Nazis from all over Europe had come. The place was stuffed with money, in gold and in currency, from a dozen countries, with art treasures. Göring's collection alone contained 5 Rembrandts, a Van Gogh, a Renoir, and much more. It was bursting with booze, jewelry, fabulous cars. So Berchtesgaden was really 2 magnets, the symbolic home of Hitler's mad lust for power and the best looting possibilities in Europe. Everybody wanted to get there, French advancing side by side with the 101st, British coming up from Italy, German leaders who wanted to get their possessions, and every American in Europe. Easy Company got there first. On May 4th, the 101st moved out by convoy down the Autobahn between Munich and Salzburg, with 2nd Battalion in the lead. The Americans passed Rosenheim and the Chiemsee. At Siegsdorf, they turned right on the direct highway to Berchtesgaden. About 14 kilometers down the road, they ran into the tail of the French 2nd Armored Division, the first division to enter Paris, with its famous commander, General Jacques-Philippe Leclerc. The 2nd Armored supposedly had been on the right flank of the 101st for the past week, but the Americans had not been able to keep in touch with it. The French were there 1 minute, gone the next. So far as the Americans could make out, they were looting their way through Germany. Whenever they got a truckload or two of loot, they'd send it back home to France. Now they were lusting to get into Berchtesgaden, only an hour's drive or so up into the mountains to the south. But the French were stopped by a blown bridge over a deep ravine. They did not have bridging equipment, and some SS fanatics were holding out on the south side of the ravine using automatic weapons and mortars. Easy Company and the remainder of 2nd Battalion began mixing in with the French, everyone standing around watching a long-range, useless exchange of fire while waiting for the 101st Engineers to come forward. Winters asked Sink if he wanted to send a platoon to outflank the German roadblock. "No," Sink replied. "I don't want anybody to get hurt." That was sensible. There was no point to taking casualties at this stage of the war. But there was Berchtesgaden just on the other side of the roadblock, almost in hand. Sink changed his mind. "Take the 2nd Battalion back to the Autobahn," he told Winters, "and see if you can outflank this roadblock and get to Berchtesgaden." If he succeeded, Sink wanted him to reserve the famous Berchtesgadenhof for regimental HQ. Winters led the battalion on a backtrack to the Autobahn, then east to Bad Reichenhall, where another blown bridge stopped the Americans for the night. The following morning, May 5th, with Easy Company leading the way, the 2nd Battalion drove unopposed to Berchtesgaden and took the town without having to fire a shot. It was like a fairy tale land. The snow-capped mountains, the dark green woods, the tinkling icy creeks, the gingerbread houses, the quaint and colorful dress of the natives provided a delight for the eye. The food, liquor, accommodations, and large number of Luftwaffe and Wehrmacht service women, plus camp followers of various types, provided a delight for the body. Accommodations were the first order of business. Winters and Lieutenant Welsh went to the Berchtesgadenhof. As they walked in the front door of the hotel, they could see the backs of the service personnel disappear around the corner. They went into the main dining room, where they saw a waiter putting together a large set of silverware in a 4-foot-long velvet-lined case. There was no need for orders. Winters and Welsh simply walked toward the men, who took off. The Americans split the silverware between them. 45 years later, both men were still using the Berchtesgadenhof silverware in their homes. After getting what he most wanted out of the place, Winters then put a double guard on the hotel to stop further looting, as he put it, with a straight face, in one of our interviews. But he berated himself. What a fool I was not to open the place to the 2nd Battalion. Because when regimental and then divisional HQ arrived, they took everything movable. Winters picked one of the homes of Nazi officials perched on the hillside climbing the valley out of Berchtesgaden for his battalion HQ. He told Lieutenant Coing, his S4, to go to the place and tell the people they had 15 minutes to get out. Coing was a replacement officer who had joined up in mid-February back in Hagenau. He had not been hardened by battle. He returned a few minutes later to tell Winters, "The people said no, they would not move out." "Follow me," Winters declared. He went to the front door, knocked, and when a woman answered, he announced, "We are moving in, now." And he and his staff did just that as the Germans disappeared somewhere. Did I feel guilty about this? Winters asked himself in the interview. Did my conscience bother me about taking over this beautiful home? No. We had been living in foxholes in Normandy. We had been in the mud at Holland, the snow in Bastogne. Just a few days earlier, we'd seen a concentration camp. These people were the reason for all this suffering. I had no sympathy for their problem, nor did I feel that I owed them an explanation. Nor did the enlisted men have the slightest problem, physical or psychological, in taking over the SS barracks, an Alpine-style apartment house block that was the latest thing in modern design, plumbing, and interior decoration. Officers and sergeants got sumptuous homes of Nazi officials perched on the mountainsides overlooking Berchtesgaden. Winters set up the guard around town, mainly to direct traffic and to gather up surrendering German troops to send them to POW cages in the rear. Private Heffron was thus in command at crossroads when a convoy of 31 vehicles came down from the mountain. At its head was General Theodor Tolsdorf, commander of the 82nd Corps. He was quite a character, a 35-year-old Prussian who had almost set the record for advancement in the Wehrmacht. He had been wounded 11 times and was known to his men as Tolsdorf the Mad because of his recklessness with their lives and his own. Of more interest to E Company men, he had been in command of the 340th Volksgrenadier Division on January 3rd in the bitter fighting in the Bois Jacques and around Foy and Noville. Tolsdorf expected to surrender with full honors and then be allowed to live in a POW camp in considerable style. His convoy was loaded with personal baggage, liquor, cigars, and cigarettes, along with plenty of accompanying girlfriends. Heffron was the first American the party encountered. He stopped the convoy. Tolsdorf said he wished to surrender. Heffron summoned a nearby second lieutenant. Tolsdorf sent the lieutenant off to find someone of more suitable rank. Heffron, meanwhile, seized the opportunity to liberate General Tolsdorf's Luger and briefcase. In the briefcase, he found a couple of iron crosses and 500 pornographic photographs. He thought to himself, a kid from South Philly has a Kraut general surrendered to him. That is pretty good. Everyone was grabbing loot at a frantic pace. German soldiers were everywhere. Wehrmacht, Waffen-SS, Luftwaffe, officers, non-coms, privates, looking for someone to surrender to. And Dog, Easy, and Fox companies of the 506th were the first to get to them. From these soldiers, Webster wrote to his parents on May 13th, we obtained pistols, knives, watches, fur-lined coats, camouflage, jump jackets. Most of the Germans take it in pretty good spirit, but once in a while we get an individual who does not want to be relieved of the excess weight of his watch. A pistol flashed in his face, however, can persuade anybody. I now have a Luger, two P-38s, a Schmeisserer machine pistol, two jump smocks, one camouflage winter jacket, several Nazi flags about 3 feet by 2, and a watch. The Eagle's Nest had been thoroughly worked over by the Army Air Force. The elevator to it had been put out of action. But to men who had been up and down Currahee innumerable times, the climb to the top was more a stroll than a challenge. Alton Moore was one of the first to get there. In the rubble, he found two of Hitler's photo albums filled with pictures of the famous politicians of Europe who had been Hitler's guests. An officer from the company demanded that Moore turn over the albums to him. Moore refused. The officer threatened to court-martial him. Moore was in Malarkey's platoon. Malarkey ran to Battalion HQ to see Winters. He explained the situation. Winters told his Jeep driver to take Malarkey back to his quarters and return with Private Moore and all his gear. When Moore arrived, Winters made him a driver for Battalion HQ. Thus was Moore able to take the albums home with him to Casper, Wyoming. With lodging taken care of and having looted more than they could carry or could ever hope to get home, the next thing these young Americans needed was a set of wheels. No problem. In the vehicle park in and around town, there were German Army trucks, sedans, Volkswagens, and more, while scattered through the town and in the garages attached to the hillside homes were luxury automobiles. Sergeant Hale got a Mercedes fire engine, complete with bell, siren, and flashing blue lights. Sergeant Talbert got one of Hitler's staff cars, with bulletproof doors and windows. Sergeant Carson got Hermann Göring's car, the most beautiful car I have ever seen. We were like kids, jumping up and down. We were kings of the road. We found Captain Spears. He immediately took over the wheel, and off we went through Berchtesgaden, through the mountain roads, through the country with its picture-book farms. As more brass poured into Berchtesgaden on May 7th and 8th, it was more difficult for a captain to hold on to a Mercedes. Spears got orders to turn it over to regiment. Carson and Bill Howell were hanging around the car when Spears delivered the sad message. Carson asked Howell if he thought those windows really were bulletproof. Howell wondered, too. So they paced off 10 yards from the left rear window, aimed their M1s, and fired. The window shattered into 1,000 pieces. They gathered up the broken glass and walked away just as a captain from regiment came to pick up the car. Before Talbert turned over his Mercedes, he, too, did some experimenting. He was able to report to Winters that the windows were bulletproof, but that if you used armor-piercing ammo, it would get the job done. Winters thanked him for his research, agreeing that one never knew when this kind of information would come in handy. The men tried another experiment. They drained the water from the radiator of the Mercedes to see if it could run without it. With a third luxury car, they decided that before turning it in, they would see if it could survive a 30-meter crash, so they pushed it over a cliff. So the brass got luxury automobiles without windows or water or wrecks. Talbert's Mercedes burned out the engine trying to climb the road to the Eagle's Nest.
The men ended up with trucks, motorcycles, Volkswagens, scout cars, and the like, which were good enough. And anyway, the fuel came as free as the vehicle. The Americans would just fill up and drive off. It was a unique feeling, Winters recalled. You can't imagine such power as we had. Whatever we wanted, we just took. With lodging and wheels taken care of, the next thing was liquor. Every cellar held some wine, but the greatest cache of all was discovered by one of the few non-drinkers in the battalion.